Welcome, everyone, to the second episode of Obsessed and So Obscure, a Matt Berry music podcast. I think I can speak for all of us when I say we are very glad to be back. I'm Tara, and we have Courtney and Jesse here. And today we are focusing on the Opium album.
Very contentious discussion. Yeah. The three of us have very different views on this album, ranging from intense love to hate's a strong word.
I don't hate it.
Maybe a spirited dislike.
I strongly dislike it.
I just can't.
And everywhere in between.
But you didn't dislike the whole thing, so you know, we're gonna go over it and kinda
It down.
And you know, it just, for me, I recognize that he did this very early on, and I appreciate how incredibly difficult that is to do. There's no way in hell I could do that. Couldn't even come close to doing that. But I don't like spoken word. I just don't like it at all. And that's basically what this whole album is. So I have thoughts. I have thoughts on it, and they're going to be a little harsh, but it's just this one. Apparently there's something about it he doesn't like either, because he doesn't want it released again. So we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah, so it was originally released in 2005. So it came not too long after Jackpot. And it was also released on the Rillington Players. So it was self-released. And there was not that many copies out originally. And then they did a reissue in 2015. Also not that many copies. So it's very hard to find, very expensive. I've been looking for it everywhere. I'm constantly on Discogs seeing if there's copies. They're just very expensive.
It was released originally on vinyl as part of the Kill the Wolf box set that came out in 2013. And that's the first time it came out on vinyl, and it has the alternate artwork with the eyeball in a piece of fruit. Looks like a peach, maybe. I can't
tell. I think it's a poppy.
So cool.
Is it a poppy?
I think it's like a Remembrance Day poppy.
Oh.
It's so cool.
To me, it just looked like fruit. So it originally came out on vinyl in 2013 as part of that box set, and then it was re-released in 2015 on vinyl and CD. So it has had a run, for sure. But that is the end of the run, apparently, because he no longer wants it released and has been pulled from streaming services.
This is a strange album, and it's a little hard to find quotes talking about the concept for this album. It's not one, when it first came out, Matt wasn't all that well known, and so he wasn't talking about it a lot in interviews. And as we've kind of talked about, he doesn't have a lot of love for this album nowadays, and doesn't really like to acknowledge it much in interviews. So when we talk about where the concept for Opium comes from and the inspiration for this album comes from, there's not a lot to go off of. We were able to dig up a few older interviews from blogs, magazines, where he touches on his inspiration for this album and what he was trying to do with it. There is a August 2007 issue of Bearded Magazine, I believe now defunct Bearded Magazine, where he is asked where the concept from Opium comes from. And he answered, "It was just something I wanted to do. I've always liked the actors' albums. By that I mean Peter Wingard's album, not so much William Shatner, but when you have an actor who does spoken word over rock music. I've always loved those and really wanted to do something like that. Shatner's is more ridiculous. I like to go towards Peter Wingard more."
He also said in that same interview, what inspired you to move away from the comical musical aspects of 80 BC and turn to the more serious aspects of Opium? And for those of you that don't know, 80 BC was a spoof rock opera that he created after they made Garth Marenghi. And it was written with, Matt wrote it with Richard Iowati. And it's basically a spoof of Jesus Christ Superstar, because he is a huge fan of Jesus Christ Superstar. And it's brilliant. It's so great. It's on YouTube.
So good.
Yeah. But he said his response to this question was, "None of it is serious. I mean, there is serious intent, but I'm not that serious. I don't feel that most of the songs on 80 BC would be out of place on Opium."
Which I'm going to call BS on, because if you actually listen to this album, and we're going to break it down for you, I think there is a lot on here that is serious in intent and not comedic at all. So I think that he might be kind of deflecting a little and sort of minimizing his own work here.
There are definitely serious themes that run throughout, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep, with the comedy. I mean, it's I find some of the songs very funny, and we'll, of course, get into that more. And then just another quote that we found pretty interesting. It was from Sonic Contact from February 2008. We think it was a blog, I guess. He says, Barry describes Opium as a spoken word concept album about the horrors of the city. He is unwilling to elaborate much on these sketchy details, but says the album is semi-autobiographical. So he says, when you're writing, certain things happen to you which give your songs similar themes, explains Barry. For me, there were two or three large themes that affected most songs. When it comes to identifying what these themes are, Barry is intriguingly vague. Just degradation, he says. Overdoing things, horrible things. It would seem Barry is no stranger to the libertine tendencies he often portrays on screen.
Yeah, my thoughts are that I think that some of this is really autobiographical, dealing with things that he's actually personally dealt with. And I also think that some of it may be friends or acquaintances, and he's pulled from that. But it's very deep. It's very heavy. There's themes of degradation, like it says throughout, but also, you know, substance abuse and just a lot of different things that are going on. All this stuff may remain a mystery, but there's just no way of knowing. That's why we speculate, because we don't know.
We love to speculate.
Exactly. Right. So I guess we'll just jump in and get this over with on my behalf. Let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the intro.
Without trepidation, I give to you Opium.
Take on the intro is the music is really, really amazing. There, you get that first little hint of what will become Snuffbox in the future, but just that spoken word really just bugs me. I just can't do it.
And Jesse, I have to say, I kind of love it. I love how theatrical it is. Yeah. I love some of the wordplay that's evident right off the bat. It's one of the questions that I have listening to this whole album is, how much of this is ironic? How much is sincere? You really can't tell. But I love how it feels like a musical, just laying the scene. And something that I noticed in the music that really stood out to me is, once it goes into the instrumental piece, you hear bits of other songs that show up later in the album. You hear bits of One More Hit, Love Is a Fool, White Hood. This is like an overture. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is taken straight from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Very much so. You can definitely see where that influence comes in. And I actually have in my notes, when I was going through and listening, I actually have Sets Up Madness That Will Ensue. That's exactly what I wrote about the intro.
No, so, that's good.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I feel like there is a way to do spoken word. And that's why I feel like this, I don't feel like it was sincere. I feel like this was a concept. And like he said, he was trying to mimic what was done in the 70s. And it's fine. I mean, you do a concept album. That's totally fine. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. But as far as like spoken word goes, he, on the Phantom First album, Peter Cleopatra and the Windmill didn't make the cut for Phantom Birds. And it's in the Phantom First part of the Gather Up box set that just came out. And it's brilliant. Like, it's so good. And that's not usually something that I like, but it's just such a good story. And he read it, like, in his own voice, not in that jokey actor Stephen Toast voice, you know?
Theater voice.
But I give this, I give the intro 2 stars. 2 out of 5. That's what my hot take is on it.
I'm going to say 3.5.
Are we doing half stars? I wasn't aware of that, but that's okay.
I don't know. I'm probably going to throw them in.
And I'm going to be the troublemaker here. I'm going to say 4 stars out of 5. I think it sets the scene so well.
It does.
It's like a statement of purpose for the
album. It does.
It does. And I do like what you said about the montage of all the songs. That was a really good observation that it didn't really occur to me until you mentioned it. So moving on to Reach for the Ground. This is actually, I think, doesn't, I don't, I just feel like it doesn't belong on this album because it's too good.
It's the same old cliche. I'm riding high on a letdown. Now it's all gone that way. Reach for the ground.
I think it's this song really just speaks to me because I think that all of his songs like this do. But for me, you could pull this particular song out and plop it on the Small Hours, and I think it would be perfect. I think it would. It just deserves to be brushed off and given the current Barry treatment because it's so good. The chorus is same old cliche, riding high on letdown, and how it's all gone that way, reach for the ground. So it's just very self-deprecating, and I don't know. It's good. I like it.
To me, like, I don't dislike this song. It's not my favorite on the album, but I think it needs a remastering. Like, I don't think the vocals are maybe as good as they could be.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's the vocals are kind of in the background. And I don't know if that was the intention or if that was just his skill set at the time. But yes, I think it could definitely do with him remastering. But I just think the song is too good to just not have anybody hear it anymore.
And it's interesting to note that this was actually the first song he ever wrote when he was 17. So that's just... that's crazy. Yeah. That's so that's skilled.
Really impressive.
I think we saw that in an article
from Metro Magazine.
Metro Magazine.
Yeah. February 2015. Yeah. I think it's also worth noting that he kept this song in his live set for quite a while after this album was released. Like, this is clearly a song that's near and dear to his heart. It's clearly a song that he feels proud of. Even into, I believe, into the Kill the Wolf era, when he had largely abandoned these songs, this is one of the ones he kept playing.
I have to go back and see if I can find some of those on YouTube, because I remember him doing it like a acoustic version, but I don't know that I've seen it after that. 4 out of 5 stars for me.
I'm going to go with 5 out of 5. I think this is the emotional heart of the album. I think it really lays down the themes of the album around kind of this debauchery and feelings of aimlessness. Yeah, I think this is just a really great song.
And what's funny is because I am, like, so opium, I'm all about this album, I'm going to give it a 3. I like the song. I don't often skip it if I'm listening, but it doesn't hit me as hard as some of the other ones. So yeah, I'm going to give it a strong 3.
3.25.
Yeah.
After Reach for the Ground, it ends with this kind of transition into synths, and that leads us right into a song that is going to feel familiar to most Matt Berry fans, even the casual fans, which is Love is a Fool, a song that became best known down the line as the basis for a theme from Snuffbox.
I feel I could die now it's over. She didn't say why, which is colder.
I think this is where he really, we mentioned earlier that he saw this as a concept album about the horrors of the city, and the lyrics here are sleazy, they're overtly sexual. I think this is very much a song about the horrors of the city and kind of the just grittiness of being young in London.
I actually jotted down when I was listening to this. The storytelling is good with questionable lyrics, which is basically all of Opium. But this one in particular, I thought had a really good storytelling intro.
Like a stroke, like a comet, like a burning shell shot from a 45. She appeared, she inspired, to control of my body, to control of my mind.
He's definitely playing with vocal styles here. He starts out with this very kind of bombastic, like actorly spoken word, and then goes into vocals that are really kind of higher pitched and like owe a lot more to glam rock than he would typically do. He's really actually, one of the things that I think is interesting throughout this album is he's playing around with his vocals a lot more than he would do in subsequent albums. Like, he's really showing off his range. And he definitely shows off his vocal range on this album in a way that I think is kind of fun.
Yeah, it is fun, isn't it?
It's a fun great song. Album.
I was just going to say, I gave it 3 out of 5.
That's pretty good for you.
Yeah, I don't hate it, for sure. I don't know what to say about it. I was going to actually pull it up because I couldn't even think of what it sounded like in my head.
It's like, I love this song, but I tend to listen to Love is a Fool again, kind of instead of it. Just hits me harder, just like it a lot better. So this one, you know, it's, I'd say 4 out of 5. I do love it.
I'd agree with 4 out of 5. Something that he does a lot on this album is he'll kind of, like we talked about during the introduction, he'll plant seeds of these songs and then bring them back later on. And he definitely does that later on with Love is a Fool Again, where he sort of brings out a whole other side of the song. It's a lot more vulnerable.
And I love that he does that. Like, it's so interesting because, like, you have something in your head. You know, he has a beat in his head, tune in his head, and then seeing kind of different directions he can go with it. And so, I mean, this one, you have the original, quote unquote, is like Trouser Department, which we just talked about in the last podcast. And then, so you have Love is a Fool, Love is a Fool Again, Snuffbox. So I just think that's really cool how he's kind of like constructed the song in different ways. And
yeah, he definitely reuses melodies. There's so many good musical elements. And I just feel like it gets so overshadowed by the hokiness of some of it, which is really a shame. I just think it's a shame. So did we do a rating for Love is a Fool?
Yeah, Tara and I gave it 4 out of 5.
Okay, and I gave it 3. So then let's officially talk about Lay Your Love on Me.
And this is a song where he leans into the storytelling hard.
On Brick Lane, above the frying pan public house, I removed my boots to make love. As the coins from my pocket hit the untreated wooden floorboards, a large number of roaches scurried from beneath the single mattress.
This is very much a song that's told from the point of view of a character. And I've always wondered if this was a song told from the perspective or sung from the perspective of Jack the Ripper.
I thought that too.
Some very highly specific references. He starts by referencing the Frying Pan Public House, which is a real pub in London that Jack the Ripper was known to frequent, that his victims, I should say, were known to frequent.
Did he talk about Brick Lane in this one also?
He does talk about Brick Lane. That's right.
That's also a Jack the Ripper reference, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's where he murdered his victims. They were all ladies of the night.
Very possible. And I think this song especially, let me first point out, there's both a fart and a burp in the intro. Just wanted to put that out there. I feel like the storytelling of the intro is really, really good. And then, because it really sets a tone, like you said, like this creepy Victorian Jack the Ripper vibe. And then the music is just really sweet and lovely.
Lay your love on me. So come lay your love on me. I'd walk through sand in summertime.
It's just snow. So
there's
disjointed.
High contrast, and also the spoken word is very harsh. And then it gets into the chorus, and it's so melodic. It's just jarring.
Yeah, it really is. It just goes from one extreme to another. And somehow I kind of feel like it works, but then not really. I think it's too disjointed with the two different really opposite ends of the spectrum elements to it. But both of those elements are really good, just not together.
I'm going to agree with you on that one. I think that this one is just too much mood whiplash. I think the spoken word intro, as much as it strikes a mood, it definitely hits a tone, but it's really goofy. I mean, you mentioned the burp noise and the fart noise, and it feels like a skit, and it feels like it just kind of undermines this really gorgeous chorus that he wrote.
Yeah,
totally agree. 100%. I gave it 2 stars.
I give it a solid 3, and I want to know, what does Matt think of the burp nowadays? Is he still like good with that, or is he like, oh, I shouldn't have done that?
Well, that's one of the things that I'm wondering about in this whole album. Like, this is just my pure speculation. We know that he doesn't want it released. We know that he doesn't want it on streaming. And is the reason because of things like that, like the burp, and then there's an occasional fart, and there's some real hokiness to it. I don't think it has anything to do with it being very personal, because The Small Hours is very personal. Phantom Birds is very personal. This is just stuff that he writes about. So I don't think it has anything to do with that. I really just think because it was a concept of his, and I think people just think it's a joke, and I just feel like that's probably not what he wants out anymore, because he doesn't, this isn't a joke to him anymore. Like, I feel like he was still trying to find his way with music when he did Jackpot and when he did Opium. He wasn't really sure still which direction to take it. So I really think that that's probably the reason, although his management doesn't give any specifics. They just say he doesn't want it out. So, and it's a controversial decision because it's a big fan favorite. People are constantly saying, when's Opium going to get released? When's Opium going to be released? When's it going back on Spotify? Never. Yeah,
we love this shit.
Yeah.
Courtney, what did you rate this? Did you rate this yet?
I have not rated this yet. And gosh, I'm torn on this one. I'm going to go with a 3.5. And for me, it wins points because of that gorgeous, like, slow, hypnotic build at the end, the making love above the pub with those multi-track vocals. I just can't get enough of that part. I just wish this is a song that he had edited a little more judiciously.
I think that's very fair.
Yeah, I agree. There are a lot of gems on this, and I feel like it's, I feel like it's a shame to throw it away completely and never want it re-released. There are things on here that I feel like he could take back if he did ever want to re-release it and really clean up and get rid of some of the jokey elements, make them actual music, make them real songs. Don't, you know, take out the jokes. So
that would be pretty cool. I would definitely be all about that.
I don't know if that's something he would consider.
Probably not, because again, once he's done something, he's like, it's gone. It's done.
He doesn't like to list back.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
I get it. So moving on to White Hood, and I kind of just got into the French part of this and spent a really long time going through the French lyrics and trying to figure out what the heck he's saying.
Je pourrais tout aussi rapidement, aussi rapidement comme la pluie. Je rêve de faire l'amour à vos mordants.
I'm from Canada. So I have, like, Canadian French. It's not, like, the real French French. So maybe somebody else who, you know, speaks a lot better than I do might have a different take on what he's saying. He says, he sings anyways. Je pourrais te poser rapidement, aussi rapidement comme l'apprend. Je rêve de faire l'amour. And then it's unintelligible. I've looked everywhere. Nobody has the lyrics for this. Everybody just doesn't write anything for this online. They're like, I don't know what he's saying. So my translation of this is, again, it could be wrong. I could take you quickly as it takes. I dream of making love. And then it's unintelligible. I think I hear the word mondant, which I'm thinking is like a mispronunciation of moaned, which means world. So if that's what he's actually saying, it's I dream of making love to your world, which I kind of really like. Like, I'm in my mind, that is like canon now. That's what he's saying for sure. And then he says in another part a little bit later, je rêve de faire l'amour à vos lapins, and le papillon est mort et il attend.
Je rêve de faire l'amour à vos lapins, le papillon est mort et il attend.
So that means, in my dream, I'm making love to your rabbits, okay? And the butterfly is dead, and she awaits.
What would a Matt Berry album be without the obligatory rabbit reference?
Right, yeah.
The man loves his rabbits.
He does.
Yeah.
Totally forgot about that.
I love that line.
Do we think that, I was going to say, do we think that he just put something into Google Translate and translated it to French, and then that's why it's kind of rough? But Google Translate didn't exist back then, although there were other translation options available.
I have no clue. Like, and again, it's not, and I'm hoping somebody who's actually French listens to this and can be like, okay, no, this is what he's saying. You're totally wrong, Tara. Like, get it together. But, you know, from what I'm going off of, it's not excellent French by any means. And I even tried to like Google translate it to see if like, okay, maybe it means something else. And it was a little bit gibberishy. So I'm not judging you, Matt. I appreciate that you tried because I do like the French. Just, you know, I'm not 100% sure if it was what he intended.
I don't speak French whatsoever, and it sounded really good to me. So,
I mean, hey, it sounds good coming out of his mouth, because pretty much everything sounds good coming out of his mouth.
Yeah. Very true. Very true.
Exactly.
What's interesting about this song, and this shows up later in the album too, is this is kind of the first appearance of that hangman imagery that really came up a lot in his early career. Obviously, on the acting side of things, in Snuffbox, he plays a hangman, and that comes up over and over. And he's claimed that this was all accidental, but for whatever reason, in this era of his life, he was very fascinated with hangmen and
all about
executions.
It.
I was actually listening to something today where he was talking about how he has a recurring dream, or he did at the time, had a recurring dream about being executed. I wonder if that maybe was playing a part in this. I don't know if hanging was the execution style, but I wonder if maybe that was sort of creeping up in his dreams a bit. But he's also very anti-death penalty too. Mm-hmm. So that could be anti-capital punishment. So that could be part of it, you know, life imitating art sort of thing. I don't know. But I gave White Hood 1 star.
It's 2 stars for me.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say 2.
One interesting tidbit about this song is this found a later life. So this song ends with a sax solo, as do several songs on this album. And for those of you who are astute listeners of Toast of London, which he would do 8 years after this, he actually reused that melody from the song The End. That's the episode where he writes the perfect novel but can't think of the ending. As much as he tries to distance himself from the album, he has reused elements of this over and over throughout his career, and that's just a direct riff that he repurposed for that show.
That's a good observation.
Very good. Very good observation. I knew when I was listening to it, I was like, why does this sound so familiar, this end part? Because I actually noted the sax solo, and then, you know, it's a really great solo, but I couldn't help thinking how familiar it sounded. And as soon as you mentioned Toast, I was like, oh yeah, that's what it is. Remember exactly that part. Yeah. Overall, though, I give White Hood 1 star.
Yeah, I give it 2 stars. I'm not really all about this song.
And I would say 2 stars as well. I like what he's trying to do here, but ultimately the song itself kind of plods along. Like, there's just, it's sort of forgettable in the
yes.
end.
So the next one, Opium. And I love this song.
That's just not true. I never promised you a thing. Now you're dealing with an all-time low. All the animals will have to go. Goodbye. Is that a tear or do I lie?
Wipe those eyes.
Never had a chance to say to you all the things I wanted to.
I love songs. It's so good.
The lyric, if I could return to that old dream, you'd lie beside me in the stream. Like, is that not poetry?
Yeah.
Come on.
It really
That's
is good.
Beautiful.
I actually meant to go back and check the lyrics for the song because I couldn't. I wanted to actually see what he was saying, and I just forgot to do it. But yeah, I remember when I was like really concentrating on it, I'm like, really beautiful lyrics in this song. And it's very, I think of the entire album, this one is the most earwormy too. Like it definitely will get stuck in your head.
It's very earwormy. It definitely has a Britpop influence that you don't really hear a whole lot in the rest of the album. But to me, after White Hood, which is such a dark song, this feels like a breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
It's poppy. It's got kind of that Beatles thing. He performs his own vocal harmonies. This is just such a bright little song.
For sure. And actually, I also think maybe because it is so upbeat as compared to the last song, I kind of almost feel like it has a little bit of a jingle quality, kind of like a TV theme sort of tune to it, that it could be, not the lyrics probably, but it just sounds very upbeat, like something where you're expecting something fun to come next.
It does. And that's actually such a contrast with the lyrics themselves, because if you listen to what he's singing about, this is a breakup song.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not true. I never promised you a thing. This is about leaving someone behind and then almost having some schadenfreude about how they're suffering without you, how they're really not doing well. This is also the song where he most explicitly talks about leaving the countryside for the city. He says in the lyrics, the countryside has left me dry. He talks about the clothes I wear are made from flags.
So where to now? The countryside has let me down.
Like those
in a city, streets and paving slabs. All the clothes I wear are made from flags.
It's interesting because he did an interview around this time where he gave that as an example of a funny line from this album. And I don't know, maybe the humor's kind of lost on me. Maybe it's an American thing, but I don't get it.
I didn't get it either. I know what interview you're talking about. I listened to it also, and I was like, really? That's the one that you picked, Clothes Made of Flags? But it did stand out to me when I was listening to it. That particular lyric stood out, like, what does that mean? And then apparently it was just something he thought was funny, so he put it in there.
This is another one that kind of had more of an afterlife than the album itself. He was still performing this live on the Kill the Wolf tour in 2013. There's a video from May 12, 2013, floating around YouTube, where he gives a really great performance of this. So this is obviously a song that he is proud of on this album and kept around a little longer.
He should be. I think this is one of the better ones. I gave it a 3. 3 stars.
That's all you're giving it? What?
Yeah, well.
Jesse!
I can't just be giving stars away. I can't be giving stars away all the time.
You can for this song. This one is so good.
Yeah.
I only gave Reach for the Ground 4, and I really like that song.
Oh, okay. Okay. At least Courtney knows what's up.
Someone has to be the voice of reason.
Yeah. And then so moving on to The Hangman, I'm just going to be honest. I skip this one almost all the time. I feel bad saying that. I really love the line, an apology is weak, regret is wretched. It's such a great line, but I have to admit, and I always thought it was but regret is wretched, but apparently it's a regret. I've been listening to this album for like, I don't know, 14 years. And I was like, oh, one of my favorite lines. I was just wrong.
Oh, that happens a lot. Everybody mishears song lyrics.
Alone in my bed, I revisit the day's occurrences, making all the necessary alterations. An apology is weak. A regret is wretched.
So my favorite line from this song, because I think it is hilarious, it is, send in the clowns, they said, but by all means try it, but do be prepared for the mass of blood and red noses, for I am in no mood for such twisted capers.
Send in the clowns, they said, by all means try it, but do be prepared for the mass of blood and red noses, for I am in no mood for such twisted capers.
I have no idea what that means, but when I heard blood and red noses, I literally laughed out loud because that's just like such a funny image. Plus, I hate clowns, so that was even funnier for me for that reason.
Yeah, they're spooky.
There's kind of more Matt trademarks that come up here. There's more rabbit references. He references the spring hare, more Bible references. He talks about man built from clay with the strength of 7. I have no idea what the hell he's talking about here. These lyrics are basically gibberish, but they clearly mean something to him.
Like the spring hare, I shall run and run and run, knowing the second I stop, if only to catch breath, it would all be over. I then become the prey. Even the man, built from clay with the strength of 7, is of little consequence as soon as the carpet of love is ripped from beneath his feet.
The whole song is just so out there. I mean, I don't know. Like, the lyric that Tara mentioned is very, I think it's very poetic. I actually really like it. And then talking about clowns and blood and red noses and then, yeah, I don't know. It it's all
off
over
the rails.
Yeah. It does. It's all over the place. I give the Hangman 1 star.
I agree. For once I agree with you, I'm going to give it a 1.
What?
Yeah.
You know,
it's not
it gets
good.
2 stars from me. I'm being very charitable
you
this
really
album.
You really are.
Yeah.
2 stars just for the mass of blood and red noses.
That's really cheap. Although I think I gave it 1 star rather than 0 stars for that. Just that line. Oh my gosh.
Okay, so the next one is like, this is my jam. Okay? Love it. Hot dog.
Me a hot dog with jelly on. I've had cravings since withdrawing from low grade acid and cocaine.
I think this is the first one I ever heard from him. I have listened to it over and over again. Just like the upbeat tempo, it's so like, you know, it's so good. And then it's playing against these like really quite dark lyrics. I think it's brilliant. It's clearly about someone who is in like the depths of a pretty severe addiction. The theme of addiction, you know, it's repeated throughout this album. This isn't the first time that you hear it. But this one kind of dives right into like the depravity and the lows of addiction, the feelings of hopelessness at not being able to turn it around, you know, despite the main character obviously wanting to so badly. So the lyrics, I love this. I go see my gran, she's making me tea. Telling me stories, hassling me. I puke on the floor, not much I can do. I don't say a word, just leave, wouldn't you?
I go see my grand, she's making me tea. Telling me stories, hassling me. I puke on the floor, not much I can do. I don't say a word, just leave, wouldn't you?
I have always loved this lyric so much. I pictured this very drunk, highly irritable person hunched over in a chair in their grandmother's very floral sitting room while Gran tells a sweet but, you know, ultimately pointless story that she has told him 50 times before. He gets up, vomits on the floor, stumbles out of the room, shocked grandma just standing there with her jaw dropped, tea in hand. I just, like, I cannot listen to that song without picturing that in my head. You know, it's very dark, but it also strikes me as funny. And I think the entire song is just brilliance. I just love it.
That was a really detailed backstory. You really painted a picture there that I don't think I can unsee. It was actually, okay. It wasn't until you posted, I think you posted the lyrics in the Facebook group because you were looking for a live mm-hmm. version of this song. And yeah. I was like, holy crap. These lyrics are super dark. I would never have, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, I really never gave it much attention because I feel like the song itself is kind of hokey, like the melody, I think maybe, and it's called Hot Dog. But when I read the lyrics, I was like, well, this is clearly somebody who is at rock bottom. And mm-hmm. I just don't get how it's like, he did this a lot on the Small Hours. Like he would match really dark themes with really upbeat music and I feel like this would be one that would be representative of that album, only, you know, done much better on the Small Hours. But this one's dark for sure, and you wouldn't know it by if you just listen to the music and the you wouldn't know it if you just listen to the music. Also, there's a fart in the spoken word section of this one. Also there's a little bit of touch of the Blue Elephant in the melody of this one, I think at the end. I'd have to go back and pinpoint it for sure. But I did remember when I heard it, I jotted it down, like, that sounds like the Blue Elephant. So maybe that was a sound that he had going through for quite a while also.
Completely. And I think a lot of that is due to the synths. This is a very synthy song. At one point, I think he puts his voice through a vocoder and kind of distorts it. This song is kind of all over the place. At one point, he does a falsetto, which is kind of something to hear for someone with his yeah. deep voice. As dark as the lyrics are, he's clearly kind of having fun with it.
I know that we read in, either heard an interview or I read an interview, and I cannot find it. I've searched high and low for it, and I swear to God I did not make this up. He was talking, somebody asked him about Hot Dog and the lyrics to it, and if that was something that happened to him. And from what I remember, it was that he didn't actually puke in his on the rug. But it did happen. He went to his grand's house and he was very, very hungover, and he actually puked in her garden. So if anybody can find this interview for me, I don't remember if it was a podcast, if it was an article, or if it's a radio interview, but I cannot locate it, and it's driving me crazy. But
we all remember this, so either we're having a collective delusion or this actually happened, but none of us could find it.
Cannot find it anywhere. And a very good database of interviews, and I cannot find it. Drives me crazy. But anyway, I gave Hot Dog 2 stars.
I can't believe you're saying these words.
Sorry, Tara. It's also going to be 2 stars for me.
Y'all are crazy. I don't get it. It's obviously like a 10 out of 5 for me. Like, it's just, it's one of my favorite from him. My list is fucking awesome. And then I have a thought. Is a hot dog with jelly a British thing, or is it just like nonsense that he's saying?
No clue.
I have actually Googled this. He says jelly unk, and unk, UNC, is like a British condiment of some sort. It's not something we have in the U.S.
What? I always thought it was like uncle. Like, hey, unk. Like, what? I can't believe
now
this.
Now you are sending me to Google. I'm going to look this up.
Yeah, I was just doing the same thing. Jelly unk. What is it? It only comes up with images for some reason.
Okay, you guys, anybody who's British, you can let me know and you know, comment about it. Let us know if, like, there is a special jelly for hot dogs. Is it called jelly unk? What's the deal? I need to know. This is blowing my mind, because, again, I've listened to the song 10 billion times, so.
Yeah, nothing
really
is
furious typing.
Popping like, up, so we'll definitely need a Brit to comment on that.
We're going to move along and hope somebody knows something.
Yeah, for sure.
So then, Jet Setter.
Hi, would you mind if I sat here? Great. You know, this is my favorite nightclub in London. Yeah, I come here often. I've not seen you here before. I think I'd remember you. What do you do? Are you a model? Jet Setter? That type of thing?
I don't know what you guys are going to think of this, but I always thought it was really funny. The desperation of a horny guy trying to chat up women at a bar, trying to be so impressive. It's just, it's great. And the line, kick those blues with those dancing shoes. It's amazing. Like, I just love it.
Oh, Tara.
I love it.
Oh my gosh.
So for anyone who, for whatever reason, is listening to this podcast and hasn't heard this album, maybe if this is your introduction to these songs, this is essentially a comedy skit. He is basically playing a guy at a bar, trying to pick up, presumably a woman, by talking himself up, telling her that he's this jet setter and about to close a big business deal, and then it kind of all falls apart. It's like a one-sided comedy monologue. I'm not sure that it works. I'll confess, there is a line here that took me embarrassingly long to get. There's one part where, I'll just say the character he's playing, sort of says, touch wood. No, it's a figure of speech.
The figures are right, touch wood. I said, touch wood. Sorry? No, it's just a figure of speech.
And I've listened to this song way too many times before I realized the double entendre there.
That's so funny. Oh my gosh.
It's a good one, though.
It is a good one. The best part of the song is that it goes into black magic reggae, which is what
he calls
it.
And then he sings reggae.
I need some kind of black magic reggae to sort this one out. That's more like it.
Everybody's running around trying to find the right solution. Not getting anywhere fast in this life of money and pollution. Just give me a chance and I could help out with the evil.
Matt Berry, I love you. You're a man of many, many talents. I'm not sure that singing reggae is one of them.
It was don't see why it couldn't be one of them, but it's just not in this song. But I still gave it 2 stars for attempting black magic reggae.
Yay.
One star for me. This song is pure cringe.
It's really cringy for sure.
I give it a solid four. I like it. Come on, guys. It's fun.
It's funny, but not in the way I think it's intended to be.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Funny isn't horrific.
And again, it's probably going back to my nostalgia of it, because I did listen to this album when I first discovered Matt, and I listened to it like just so much.
Yeah. And I have no nostalgia for this album, which could also be why I don't like it very much, because the only way to have actually listened to Opium is to listen to it on YouTube. And who wants to do that? It's a complete pain in the butt. So, you know, once I got a digital version of it, it was a little different, but still don't really care to go back and listen to it.
Until I made you.
Right. I did it for the purposes of this podcast. I did it for research purposes only. And I've had too much of it.
Yeah, I'm going to take a little break after this for sure. It was a lot. I listened to one more hit. Oh, God. Yeah, I've listened to these songs a lot. So moving on. Love is a Fool Again. What do you guys think?
This is a good one.
To live on my own just seems tragic, but this pain here inside drives me crazy. I know I've been low, I've been lazy. You see, a lot left on hold's never.
This is probably the most straightforward song on the album. It's a love song. He repurposed a lot of these lyrics and just lifted them directly for a theme from Snuffbox. Mm-hmm. And obviously this is a song that's meaningful for him. There's actually quite a few performance videos floating around where he performs a theme from Snuffbox and keeps some of the lyrics from this song served as a hybrid version of the two. So this feels more personal than some of what's on this album, and I think it really works.
Yeah, it's basically Snuffbox theme with a slightly slower tempo. And then, like you said, some of the lyrics are verbatim, and then the other stuff added into it. But also at the end of this, there is a fire guitar solo at the end, and it's fantastic, and just that alone is worth it.
So everybody gives it 5 out of 5, right? Build.
Yeah.
No, I gave
5 out of 5.
I gave it 4 stars.
Okay. I don't think you're gonna have a 5 for anything, so I guess that's gonna happen.
Spoiler
to
alert. I don't.
Oh crap.
I don't know how it gets better than this song. So good.
Yeah.
So because the thing is, with any of these songs, I mean, Snuffbox, obviously, I would give that a 5 because it's great. It's much more polished and refined, and that's the final product. These were songs that were still works in progress, ultimately. So I can't give a work in progress song a 5. What it became, I would definitely give a 5.
All right. I'll take it because I have no other choice. So one more hit. I love this song too. And again, I feel like this is kind of my album compared to you guys.
I get the feeling no one here remembers my song. It was only yesterday. Now you're putting me on. I'm all out of time. Mr. Sandman, send me a dream. Make it the finest happy ending that you've ever seen. The one where I'm sober, straight and clean.
I think that this is the best song on the album. It's not necessarily my favorite one, but I think it's the best one I do. It speaks to the difficulty of making it in the arts industry and, you know, maybe not feeling like you necessarily fit in with what is considered commercially desirable. The line, I look like I do, but would you hear my song? And then, of course, the lyric, they want dancers, young gay dancers. It always, to me anyways, my interpretation was it's touching on kind of the fleeting nature of fame. He has a song, you know, he thought it was a hit. People have already forgotten about it. He's feeling quite forlorn. The lyric, I get the feeling no one here remembers my song. It was only yesterday. Now you're putting me on. I'm all out of time. Oh, it's so good. Now, obviously, like, we don't know. We know that some of this is supposed to be very, you know, autobiographical. We don't know if this song is, if it's from his perspective or just a, you know, wider observation of the industry. But back when this was made, Matt wasn't a household name when this was written and recorded. Like, he had done Mighty Boosh and Dark Place, but this was back in 2004, and Dark Place didn't actually get success until it went to the States and got a DVD release in 2006. So I would go as far as to say that, you know, at the time that this was written, he considered himself a struggling actor and musician, and he was trying to get his bills paid. So I think the struggle is just really apparent in this album, in the whole album, but in this song, One More Hit, it just, it lays it wide open, and I just think it's perfect. It's, you can emphasize with what the character is going through. I've loved it. I've always loved it. I thought it was just such a good insight into, I see it as his experience. I'm not saying that's true, but his experience, you know, before fame hit him. And I listened to this over and over again. I think it's so well written. I think it's just beautifully sung. I give this, again, I'm just going to say it, 10 out of 5 stars.
This really is a fantastic album closer. Something that I just noticed on this last re-listen, which I'd never really kind of observed before, but One More Hit is a pun. He also goes back to that drug opium theme. He talks about, in the lyrics, the one where I'm sober, straight and clean. So we've already talked about how he really references these themes of addiction quite a bit on this song. And this kind of ties it together too. Kind of dreaming of a time where he's past that, and like you said, successful and reaching his goals. Whether that is autobiographical or not, and to what degree, who knows, but it really feels like it just kind of wraps up all these themes that he's addressed.
It definitely does seem like this is someone that's dealing with personal struggles of being accepted, but I definitely think that that has to do with it, whether it's being accepted in show business or being accepted for who he is, trying to do what he does. It is interesting. I gave it 2 stars.
Oh! What? Oh my God. Oh my God. Okay.
3 for me. The music here never really like lifts off for me, but the lyrics are so interesting.
Yeah, I think that's the same for me too. It's, this one is more, much more lyric driven than music driven. And I don't know, as is, if the lyrics are strong enough to drive it. I think it needed something more than that. And I think that that's really the reason why I think it could be redone and remastered and could be a really good song. It just, in this current form, I think it's a little rough.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and you know, I think that kind of goes back to, like, I am really big into lyrics. That always is kind of what hits me with music and sticks with me. So I think, yeah, like, just the lyrics of this song and Hot Dog as well have just really stuck with me through more than a decade. So I appreciate your guys' input. It's been super interesting. Although a lot of the times you were wrong. No, I'm just kidding.
Are you, though?
I'm mostly kidding.
Hey, you knew this was going to be contentious.
I did.
We're on opposite ends of the spectrum for our love of opium.
Yeah.
And that really, I think like drives home how different this sounds from really anything else he's done. Like, this album, he really kind of made a left turn after this and went a lot more into kind of more pastoral music. He talked about how he started singing about the horrors of the countryside. We'll get there before too long, but this really feels like kind of an outlier in his discography, and I kind of love it for that. But I get where it's a love it or hate it kind of album.
I think it for sure is. It's just, I agree with what you said, that it's just not what he does now. It doesn't represent who he is now at all. And I think that because this was not the first thing I listened to, I can't really take it for what it is, because I don't really know what it is. And I think that's part of what bugs me. Like, we know he wants to be taken serious as a musician. Yeah. It's very clear that he does. And I can't take him serious with this album at all. And I really think that that's part of the problem. I think we know what Tara's favorite song from this album is, but would you like to reiterate?
Which song do you think is the favorite?
I mean, my personal favorite is Reach for the Ground. I think it's really
okay.
Good.
It's definitely not mine. But what do you think mine is from between? It's obviously between Hot Dog and One More Hit. But which one do you think is my favorite?
I think it's Hot Dog.
I'm going to guess Hot Dog. That was also the first Matt Berry song you really fell in love with, right? So it's always going to have that sentimental value.
It is, but like One More Hit is really, really close. I would say, like, again, I think it's the best one on the album. It's just, yeah, Hot Dog is my favorite. You guys are right. You know me so well.
Courtney?
So,
this is a tough one for me. I'm like looking over the track listing, trying to decide. But I think I've got to go with Opium. It's just such a little gem of a song. And like you said, such an earworm, such great melodies. He does his own backing vocals. This is just like a perfect pop song for me.
It is very good.
Yeah.
It's over. It's underrated, I think. So I think what we're going to do going forward is maybe do a burning question for Matt. And, you know, it may not necessarily have to do with what we've just talked about, but something that we would really like to know the answer to. Tara, do you have a burning question for Matt?
I do. And please, if anybody knows him who is listening to this, I need to know, will he ever re-release Opium? I am desperate. We are desperate. Everybody who did not get a chance to get a copy, please just ask him to release, do another re-release.
At least put it back on streaming. At least give us that.
Yeah, just something. So that's just my question. Is there ever going to be a re-release of Opium on vinyl?
Courtney, do you have a question?
I would just like to know how much of this album is autobiographical. You know, we referenced earlier that quote from, what was it, back in 2008, where he described it as semi-autobiographical. And I really want to know what in this album is taken from his personal life at that time. There are some themes that really mirror what we know about his life. We know that after college, we know that he grew up in a pretty rural town. He said he lived right by fields. He lived in the countryside. And then he moved to London. And that is one of the big themes of this album, moving from the country into the horrors of the city. So how much of this is taken from his life? And how much does it reflect what was going on with him at that time? That's what I'd like to know.
That's a good one. My question is, Opium was reissued in 2013 and again in 2015. His management said that the decision to pull it from streaming services and to not re-release it was his alone. And I just want to know what changed his opinion of Opium so recently. Like, it came out in 2005 originally. It was re-released 10 years later. And just for it to be pulled and decided to not re-release it between 2015 and I don't know when it was actually taken off Spotify. I want to know what...
I think it was just last year, actually.
Was it?
Because when I first discovered Matt, it was still on Spotify. And then within months, it was removed.
That's very recent then. So yeah. What exactly changed his mind on that? I mean, I think by this point, he is considered to be a serious musician. So I don't know. I don't know. I want to know if my speculation is correct, that with Opium available to the masses, do you think that people will never fully take your music seriously?
Good questions, guys.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for listening and for the amazing feedback we got from our first episode.
Yeah, we received a tweet from Marie, aka Maz, confirming Matt's early made-up label, Rillington Players, is a riff on the 1971 movie 10 Rillington Place, starring Richard Attenborough and John Hurt, about British serial killer John Christie. And as I'm never one to pass up on a good serial killer movie or documentary, I have since watched this movie, and I'm not really sure if the reference is about the movie specifically or just where John Christie's killings took place.
I also received a message from Samantha Hatfield on Facebook to let us know that the line in When Did You Last See Your Father about selling magazines may be a reference to something in the UK called The Big Issue. It's a magazine sold on the streets by homeless and insecurely housed people as a way to help them with financial support to try to alleviate homelessness. This is something we were unaware of, as we don't have anything like this here, and it could definitely be a clue behind those lyrics.
Yeah, like, very interesting. Thanks, guys, for sending in that stuff. We really appreciate it. So as always, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Obsessed Obscure. Also, the links for the quotes discussed in this episode will always be dropped in the info section if you'd like to take a closer look. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks to break down Witch Hazel. I think my heart now beats for free. You and me and Christopher Lee. I think my